Well, but really, I think.
No, we're not going to.
Have a quorum?
We're not going to deal with Nikki today.
No.
The 70, but I guess.
I don't think so.
I think it's 75.
Okay.
That's three-quarters of an inch, that's big.
Senate Committee on Health Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order, please. We're going to carry Senate Bill 1011 over until Tuesday. We're going to carry that over. So we will not hear that today at all. We're going to start with a work session on SCR 21, and then we will hear Senate Bill 1005. So we will open a work session on SCR 21.
I'm just trying to find it here real quick.
Oh.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 21, as you recall, is a concurrent resolution that commends Dr. James K. Lace for his health care services for children locally as well as internationally. At the public hearing on Tuesday, Senator Winters had requested adding another acknowledgement to Dr. Lace. You have that in the Dash 1 amendments. It's another paragraph acknowledging his recent achievement by the Marion Pope County Medical Society. And we do have a fiscal and a revenue back on that, which are both no impact at all. So okay. The committee can move forward as it sees fit.
Okay. Do we have a motion? Let me pause for just a minute. Is there anyone that we want to recognize to speak to this issue before we pass it out?
Mm-hmm. I don't think so. I think, you know, our public hearing.
We had the public hearing. I just wanted to be sure that there wasn't someone here who wanted to speak. Okay, well, we need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move SCR 21 as amended with Dash 1 dated 2/3/10 to the Senate floor where they do pass, be adopted.
Yeah, do it.
Mr. Chair. Yeah. Vice Chair Telfer, generally we adopt the amendment first and then make the motion to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of SCR 21.
Dash 1 amendment.
Okay.
Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Telfer
dated
moves.
Dated 2/3/10.
The adoption of SCR 21.
Dash 1.
Dash 1. Oh, I'm sorry.
Amendment.
The amendment. Tell us about
it.
Mr. Chair, the amendment. I'll just mention it again, is another acknowledgement for Dr. Lace of his most recent achievement given to him by the Marion Pope County Medical Society for his work.
Okay.
And we have a fiscal and revenue that releases us on that amendment as well.
Okay. Discussion of the amendment. Seeing no discussion, is there any opposition to the amendment? Seeing none, so ordered.
Now I would move SCR 21 as amended with the Dash 1 dated 2/3/10 to the Senate floor. We'll do pass.
Okay. Senator Telfer moves SCR 21 as adopt with the amendment adoption to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. Any discussion on that? Yes.
Senator Mr. Chairman, I said so before, but I want to say again, I want to thank Senator Winters. I think it's so important that we bring these people into our lives here in the building that we don't know about, that are remarkable, accomplished, and very important to the state of Oregon. So thank you very much, Senator Winters.
And Dr. Lace was present this morning in Senator Monis Anderson's health committee and testified, and he came before our committee several times last session to testify on a bill. And so in addition to all of the good work that he does in Africa and other places, he is very committed to some of the issues that are going on in the legislature, and he does take part in these issues, so I just wanted to add that. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'm just really honored to have had the opportunity to bring this to the committee and to bring it to the floor. And I would concur with the good Senator Verger. I think we probably have unsung heroes throughout our community that it would be nice to recognize them. Dr. Lace, that I've had the opportunity to work with both here in our community as well as over in Africa, has made such a tremendous contribution to here and abroad. I kind of think I've got kind of my community is great, and I'm sure we all think our community is great, and we have these individuals, and I just think that recognizing them mm-hmm. for the work that they do, the investment in the Oregon Children's Plan last mm-hmm. session, Healthy Kids was part of the work of Dr. Lake. So just glad that I could do it.
Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Winters will carry bill. Not the bill, but the
resolution.
Very good. Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1005. Could you give us an update, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you recall that we had a brief discussion on this as LC 96 as a committee bill. It is now before us again as Senate Bill 1005. This bill authorizes the Housing and Community Services Department to contract to provide compliance monitoring or other administrative functions regarding housing developments and affordable housing. You will also notice in your packet that Fiscal did issue a statement. It doesn't have any real expenditures, but it does provide explanation on how this authority will impact the department.
Okay. It'll impact it well, right?
It certainly will.
Okay. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you for giving us this time. Mm-hmm. My name is Marlis McNeil, for the record. I'm the Division Administrator for the Asset Property Management Division of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Senator Morissette, members of the committee, thank you very much for moving this forward as far as we've come. I'm here to answer any questions, further questions you might have. Happy to remind you what the bill will do, and it will allow Oregon Housing and Community Services. We've had a contract with the federal government for the last 9 years to provide HUD contract administration duties for the federal government for Section 8 projects located throughout the state of Oregon. It's been very financially beneficial to the department. It's allowed us to maintain affordability in units. It's also helped us to ensure that our low-income Oregonians live in safe, sanitary, very acceptable housing. And the money that we've been able to make have been able to ensure that programs and further housing is developed for the state of Oregon. We now have an opportunity to extend that. The contract that we've done for so many years is going to be coming up for rebid. And in our statutes, it limits our abilities to do anything outside of the state of Oregon. We would like to have the ability to change that so that if it looks like it's a business decision and we can make further funds for the department, we would like to have the ability, and that's what this Senate bill will do. Senator Winters had some specific questions of me the last time we spoke, and I'd like to address those if I could. Yeah. Senator Winters, one of the questions you asked me was if this work could be done by private individuals, a private company. This particular contract, public housing agencies like ourselves, state housing agencies, are the only ones that can provide this work. We're the only ones that can enter into the contract with HUD. We can subcontract some of the work out, some of the duties. And while HUD prefers that the housing agency does them all of the duties themselves, they will allow us to subcontract some of the duties. I just this morning received an analysis from a national entity called Quadel, and they are an entity that does contracting for this very specific knowledge that it takes to do this compliance monitoring. And we have found that they are not able to provide it cheaper than what we're able to do it. We actually, it cost us about $76 a unit to provide this service to the properties that we have. And they will charge $74 a unit. However, they will not provide any management oversight. And it's our responsibility. It would be our responsibility mm-hmm. as a contractor to provide that. And so you can see by the time we add the oversight, they're not able to do it really any cheaper than we are. And frankly, 10 years ago, I was at the agency when we bid on this property, on this contract, and it's worked very well. The residents know us. They have the ability to call. We have an 800 hotline. They know us. They know the people that provide these services, and we'd like to have that ability to continue to do it. And if we can see that it will benefit the state of Oregon, and furthermore, Oregon Housing and Community Services, we'd like the ability to expand that if we would like to. It would also give us the opportunity, if we have someone in the state, say a small housing authority or a nonprofit organization, they are, because what we do is so specialized and there's just such a very few amount of people in the state that actually know how to do this work, we're continually called on by those folks to provide this assistance. This bill would allow us to charge the developers and the management agents for this kind of expertise if we're able to do that. So I hope that answers your questions. I'll be happy to answer any further questions you may have.
Senator Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the second page of your testimony, you're talking about some housing, I guess, that's in Idaho, and we weren't able to participate, and it would have generated almost $500,000 to the state of Oregon. Explain that and what money, the money flow, et cetera.
Okay. Senator Morissette, Senator Monis Anderson, when we entered into this contract 10 years ago, it was for monitoring of compliance monitoring for properties that we had financed that had Section 8 contracts on them. And at this point, we only have the ability to do that within the state of Oregon. The public housing agencies, such as ourselves in Idaho, took the contract for the state of Idaho, did exactly the same work as we did in Oregon, and we're having a very difficult time. HUD asked us in 2005 to take over that state and do these monitoring requirements for that state as well. It would have brought in about $500,000 of income into Oregon Housing. We were not able to take advantage of that because of this restriction
in
the statute.
Thank you. Explains it very well.
You're welcome.
Is that opportunity still there?
It is. Yes, it is. And we are considering doing that.
Go ahead.
Just a follow-up on the Senator's question. Are you anticipating rather quickly, or how long out of, because I'm looking at the fiscal impact of HUD signing a contract rather quickly, or which then would mean that you would need to go to Ways and Means to get your limitation done. Can you help kind of educate us as to where you are in this process?
You bet. Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, members of the committee. We have not received the request for proposal yet. This, by the way, is a request for proposal throughout the United States. We are expecting that next month. We will be preparing our response to that request for proposal. If we are the successful candidates, we will know in the fall, about September, and the work would commence January 1st of 2011.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
Then have you submitted a request through Ways and Means for application, to apply for the application approval.
Senator Morissette, Senator Winters, not yet, not at this time.
But that is something that you plan to do if we approve and send this forward?
Yes.
Oh, Senator Telfer and Senator Brugger.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Montes Anderson asked the question, basically, but given your answer, I have a follow-up question then regarding the Idaho or any other out-of-state. So we were asked to provide the service for Idaho.
Correct.
Did we, and we provided that service?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, Senator Tepler, no, we were not able to provide it because of the statute.
Okay, so we
and
didn't
the
provide. Okay,
we
okay.
did not. That is correct.
You know who took over, who helped them?
Actually, HUD ended up having to take that responsibility back. This is a this HUD monitoring is something that the federal government did up until 10 years ago. They ended up having to take the responsibility back for that agency for a period of time until they worked with them, and now the Idaho Housing Finance Agency is providing that service again under some tighter scrutiny by the federal government.
So follow up.
Yes.
So what we've got in the bill, proposed bill right now, is in case this happens again, we have nothing on the horizon that we're considering doing for another state.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, Senator Tepler, actually, we are expecting a request for proposal from the federal government, and we are certainly going to be bidding on the state of Oregon. And once we get that request for proposal and we know exactly what the figures will be, we may be considering doing monitoring in other states. We've not yet made that decision. We're waiting for the proposal to come to us.
Okay.
Senator Brugger.
So that I really understand exactly what you're saying, what do you anticipate the timeline will be for the regionalization? In other words, if they're exploring regional bidding, when do you anticipate that they're going to decide that you can do that?
At this point, and we say at the agency there's our time and then there's HUD time, but HUD is telling us that we should have the proposal, the request for proposal, to us next month, and then we will prepare our response, make our decisions about what states, if any, we're going to be bidding on, and we would actually be advised in the fall of the year. At this point, they're expecting September 1 of 2010, with the work to commence January 1st, 2011.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you tell me what states are involved in your region?
In our region, in what they call Region X for HUD, is Alaska, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. However, what we've been told by HUD, any entity will be able to bid on any state they so choose. Above
say
and
that
beyond,
again?
Any state will be able to bid on any other state, as many as they would like, up to a maximum of 300,000 units. I doubt very much that we will be, if we bid outside of the state, it may be a smaller, it doesn't have to be in our region. So in other words, Nevada has 40 apartment communities that have Section 8 contracts. We could do that very easily with 75% of the work done right here in our offices just a few blocks away. We're going to be very careful about looking at what states and how much of a time commitment it'll take and run the numbers very carefully to make sure that it will be beneficial for us to do this. At this point, we're not even able to entertain that because of this restriction.
Do you need an emergency clause? This will take effect 90 days if we approve it 90 days after.
She wouldn't be in compliance.
Pardon me?
Point of clarification.
Yeah.
Sure.
You're asking for the ability to actually to apply for the RFP to go out state.
That is correct, ma'am. Yeah.
You also will need to have authority from Ways and Means. So this 90-day becomes very critical because you don't at this point have permission either to apply for those funds which is necessary and needed in order for you to interact with HUD.
I see.
So there's two steps in this, and that's why I was trying to get where are you in the process. And so just as you're looking for the enabling legislation, you need to actually have some conversation with legislative fiscal. And
that'll take 90 days, or will it?
Well, it shouldn't. But, but I'm just saying there's some steps that are missing here.
Okay, but question is, do you, if you had an emergency clause to allow you to actually get the process started earlier rather than waiting 90 days?
Senator Morissette, that certainly would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because legislative fiscal rules are you must get permission before you can make application to the federal government.
Okay.
And because you have, I mean, I'm going to clarify for the rest of the members, because embodied in this is also position authority.
Yes.
And you have to get position authority from Ways and Means as well. So there's some pieces here, and I want to put it on the record.
Sure.
That has to be required for you to actually implement this particular statute that you're requesting.
Okay. So what I suggest is that we hold this until Tuesday. Take a look at what Senator Winters is talking about in terms of timelines. Determine whether or not you want to add an emergency clause that would at least take effect 30 days.
Yes.
And that could come together, and I'm not sure how long that permission
will
be.
But at least we have it in the process.
Yeah. So that would clarify. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, if I might ask one more question. Do we have other agencies in the state that become, I mean, this to me is getting into a for-profit world, an activity where we're going to go out at Oregonians' expense and go out and start doing business in other states, hopefully that the money that we would generate would compensate.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know if there's a profit margin. I'm just feeling a little uncomfortable with us all of a sudden getting into the business of going into other states and managing their HUD projects. You know, I'm not sure that's what the state's purpose is.
Senator Morissette, Senator Tepler, I understand. I have to tell you that many of you have said in our budget hearings for Oregon Housing and Community Services, we are a self-supporting agency with a very, very small amount of our of general fund for our agency. We've been self-supporting. We've been in existence for over 25 years and been self-supporting, have never had to ask for general fund. Unfortunately, our bond series are starting to die down now. Because of the housing issue that is all of us have been involved in the last few years, it has really hurt our agency a lot. This has been quite frankly, a lifesaver, and has helped us keep Oregon Housing and Community Services alive. And rather than come to you with our hand out saying, help us be self-supporting, this will help us be more self-supporting so we can provide more housing for Oregonians.
And Mr. Chair, and I do look at this also as we have now state agreements with our prescription drug or our medications for our Oregon Health Plan, and been able to get our drugs for our clients much cheaper. So we are looking regionally. We're helping ourselves, the state of Oregon, but we're also helping the state of Idaho or Nevada, whoever we go with, because if they had the wherewithal to do it themselves, they would. So we keep getting input, start acting like a business, state of Oregon. Maybe it's a catch-22 here.
Mr. Chair, could I ask one piece of information,
yes.
And she can get it back to me? Just for my edification in preparation for the next hearing, could you provide, you mentioned that HUD would not contract with anybody other than another housing authority. Could you give us copies of that document?
Sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, get that to the city or the committee administrator. Senator Telfer.
Yes, sir.
Anything else?
I could want. You know, I work in the nonprofit. As CPA, I work mostly with nonprofits, and the IRS has this thing called unrelated business income tax, on revenue that's generated from something that's not their exempt purpose. And I'm just not sure, you know, the Oregon's. And so I'm a little uncomfortable. I'll have to look at that a little bit more as to all of a sudden we're now into the business of managing states. HUD programs. I can see a great for-profit business starting up that might take that task on. But
and Senator Morissette, mm-hmm. Senator Tepler, I do understand your concern. And quite frankly, once we get the request for proposal from HUD, we may look at this and not do anything but bid on our own state. But at this point, we're really hamstrung because we're not even able to do that. I certainly understand. I'm happy to chat with you at any time if you have further questions.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. The caution is that we now also have in the nonprofit world, because so many of them are getting into joint ventures with for-profits because of this exact same issue, meaning it's a way to generate revenue, it's becoming a no-no, and it's being frowned upon nationwide. So I guess I'm just a little cautious about how we're venturing into similar territory.
And I, Senator Morissette, Senator Tepler, I believe that it's important for you to understand that the specialized task and that it takes to do this kind of work, there literally are just handfuls of people in the state that are able to do that. These positions are very hard to hire for. We have to do a certain amount of on-the-job training. So this isn't something that a lot of nonprofits and even, quite frankly, a lot of for-profits have the ability to do.
Okay. There are some extenuating circumstances in this particular situation. You generate your own income. I mean, in a sense, you don't rely on general fund money
for
your
sir.
Department, and so you would be signing an agreement with HUD, which is a governmental entity. It's not a business out there somewhere where we're crossing the line and dealing with businesses. You're dealing with HUD.
That is correct.
And then that would, if you can do it, and you would have to do your due diligence, and there would be oversight and so on and so forth, then you could enter into that contract. And that would help you to stay afloat, right?
Senator
because otherwise
Morissette, that's
you would
exactly
have to come
correct.
In and ask
yes.
the legislature for money.
That's exactly correct.
Okay. Now, we're going to carry this over.
Okay.
We want you to take a look at the timeline and work with Senator Winters on that. And also, we will get an amendment for an emergency clause that would allow you then to take action if HUD suddenly comes by in the next, well, after 30 days and you have an agreement, then you can act on that. So
thank you very much.
Any other? Okay, good.
Thank you.
And we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1005, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 991, and we will start with the Senate President, Peter Courtney, and Sasha, and David Anderson. Mr. President, did you want to take the lead on this? Or?
If you would like me to do so, I will, Chair Morissette.
Yes, I would like you to do that very much.
Yes. Chair Morissette, Vice Chair Telfer, Senator Berger, Senator Winters, Senator Loy Monsanderson, I come here today to support Senate Bill 991. I'm Peter Courtney. I represent Senate District 11, which includes portions of Salem, all of Jervis and Woodburn. Senate Bill 991 is probably for me one of the most novel pieces of legislation that I've ever had my name attached to. Last summer, Sasha Pollock, my office, who sits at my right, came to me about a program she'd heard about in the city of Chicago called Safe Families. And she talked to me about it, and I didn't understand it. I just didn't understand how you have foster care, you have state intervention to deal with children who are struggling and their families, you have the relief nurseries, and I didn't quite understand what she was talking about. But it sounded like a rather unique and remarkable program in terms of the early indications of how successful it was. And so Sasha started to work on it. And here we are almost 8 months later with the person who created the program, who's flown all the way in from Chicago, Dr. David Anderson, who sits here, as well as representatives of the Department of Human Services, as well as individuals from the private sector, as well as the community sector, who've come together in a team to not only support this legislation, but are ready to go in at least two counties in the state of Oregon with it. And I'm just going to speak very globally because I don't like to read from my testimony. I do think I should always file written testimony with a committee, but I'm not going to read from it. And I'm not going to get into the details because I just came through a remarkable press conference where I literally learned so much in that press conference about this bill that I didn't know going in from the incredible questions from the media who were fascinated and from their tremendous answers as well as those in the audience. I mean, I was going, whoa, this is real, whoa, why, whoa. And so it's a remarkable press conference. I'm glad I went to my press conference, which is not a good thing to say to you because you think I should be certified smart and know everything about the program. But I'm just telling you straight up, I'll be the first to admit that often I lack the knowledge I should have even about life, let alone individual programs. What it basically does is if a family is in crisis, these words we use, they're struggling, they're in trouble, and they've got children, and they don't want to have the foster care, the state intervention, but they got to have the children taken care of for a day or two or a week, up to a year. And they want to maintain contact with those children. They don't want to lose contact. And the families that are taking care of them don't want them to lose contact. They come together as a team. How do you do this in the private sector? How can you do this? And the great city of Chicago knows how I say that because we had a very funny moment down there because now protector Dr. Dave Henderson referred to Mayor Daley of Chicago to a tremendous laugh when he did, and I had to tell him quietly, I got to talk to you about that. So anyway, but the city of Chicago is a great city, a great, great city. And they found a way to take children, put them in homes where adults often who have already raised their children but want to volunteer to take care of these children for a period of time while working with the families. And they've had remarkable results, both in terms of the number of families that have come forward and volunteered. The screening's all there. Again, I'm getting ahead of it. They can tell you how they're screening. As well as the number of children. And it's now being looked at a lot of other communities, but this will be the first state that looks at it, sort of like, can we do this on a statewide basis? I was told initially we didn't think we necessarily needed a piece of legislation. I'm particularly looking at certain individuals, you who really know the foster care system. Now I was told, yeah, you do need, because you have to exempt from certain, I don't want to say barriers, but processes and procedures that we require if you're going to do this from state law. And so that's what this law does. That's all it does. It does not create a state program. It does not create a state general fund. In fact, the first dollars for this program, which will be raised by 5 o'clock tonight by Dick Whitnell, I just said that downstairs at the press conference. He's probably one of the most extraordinary business persons I'll ever meet, highly successful in Salem, great community activist now, one of the great fundraisers. Use that figure, and I said I expect him to have it by 5 o'clock tonight. If anybody can do it, he can do it. That'll all be done in the private sector. So now I've spoken very globally, and you're probably a bit confused. So now I want to turn it over to Sasha, I believe, and then you can go to David. And then I hope you'll really assail us with your questions and comments, although we have other players there who are ready to speak, too, to show the team that's come together anxiously wants to do this. This is critical legislation. This is the cornerstone. And I really hope this committee will take it, love it, take it to the Senate floor. You can present it. You can take my name off it. Make it a committee. I don't care. But I hope we really do see the magnitude of this remarkable effort that's going on in Chicago and now many other communities. And I also hope that you will see it as a very positive way to instantly reach children and families that are struggling for whatever reason. So could I allow Sasha Pollock to speak, Chair Morissette?
Yes, yes. David, are you going to be able to follow this?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good.
So he doesn't. He's a Chicago guy. They don't. He's a Chicago guy. He's fine.
Okay. Sasha.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sasha Pollock. I work in Senator Courtney's office. As Senator Courtney said, this is not a bill to set up a new program. As I understand it, the fiscals that we've gotten so far without a finalization is a zero on this. There's no new state money going into this at all. What it is clearing a path for a program to be set up by an existing nonprofit organization to provide, through volunteers, crisis care for children in instances when their families need to give them up for a very short time. So the family is not giving up custody as they would if the child was taken by the state, but they are giving up care and control through a power of attorney. We have not changed the power of attorney statutes that are existing in law. We are using those same power of attorney statutes, but we are using them for a new respite care statute. And I'm going to go very quickly through what the bill actually does, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. David Anderson from Chicago, who can explain a little bit about the program that we're hoping this will be modeled on. So, briefly, the changes in Senate Bill 991 are as follows. It adds to the list of exemptions from child caring agencies any private agency or organization providing respite services for parents using that power of attorney that I mentioned. It defines those respite services. It clarifies that the home of a family providing respite services is not a foster home, and it adds to the list of public or private officials deemed mandatory reporters. And in the current bill, when we'd ask you to amend this, the current bill has the caregivers, the families, as mandatory reporters. We would like to change that so the staff of the organization are mandatory reporters instead, because we were worried about unintended consequences of having those volunteer families be considered mandatory reporters. Because as you all know, mandatory reporter is a 24-hour-a-day job. You can't just mandatory report on the person, on the child that's in your care. If you see something at the grocery store, you're obliged to report that as well. So we wanted to limit that a little bit. So that's in the -3 amendment, which I would submit to you for addition. We're joined today by several folks. I've been talking over the last few days, because this is so confusing on its surface, if you don't know the larger context of the Safe Families program in Chicago, it's quite confusing to just to look at this bill and say, why are we exempting some things from these very important statutes? I've been talking to a lot of stakeholders in child care services and DHS land, and we have been working with DHS all along the way in crafting this bill, and we feel very confident that it's a strong bill that will fill a hole that currently exists in kind of the realm of need in Oregon. There is a -4 amendment being drafted, and that -4 amendment goes to some concerns that I have heard expressed and that I share in terms of, we have a very reputable organization ready to set up the first pilot project, and someone will come up to talk about that in just a minute. But what if someone else wanted to come and establish another organization somewhere else, and whether they were unable to because they didn't have the resources or malicious about it, what if somehow a child got placed in an inappropriate care situation? We have drafted a -4 amendment that would require any organization that facilitates the placement of children for this respite care to enter into a reciprocal agreement with the child care division and use their central background registry to do a background check for any volunteer family that would before a child is placed in their care. And this agreement would provide for the reimbursement of costs to the division for the provision of this information. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Anderson, but I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay. The dash amendments are additions to what's going on in Chicago. Are they? Are you making tweaking their program, or are you changing the original bill?
Senator Morissette, in Illinois, and the thing that's very unique about this program, what we're doing here in Oregon, is Illinois did not set out as a state to do this. Dr. Anderson did this as a grassroots movement through his church group, and it kind of built from there. What we're trying to do is kind of the opposite. We want to say, we would love to see this happen in Oregon. We don't want anybody to run into any roadblocks in making this happen, so we'd like to clear the way for this to happen. It is my understanding and my belief that the Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments make the program in Oregon more similar to what's actually going on in Chicago.
Okay, what will be the difference between the state involvement in Oregon? Okay, this is enabling legislation for a private organization or public
yes.
nonprofit to operate. That's what we're doing.
Yes.
The state is not involved in
it. Correct.
And Chairman said, we don't have any other states to model this on. We would be the first.
Okay.
Even those other communities, this is the first state that's looking at it in a statewide way. So we have no other state to say, what do they do? We do have Chicago and his expertise, but we don't have other states to look at right now.
Okay. And I see Mickey Cerise back there, who will be up later.
Yeah, they're all there. I mean, you can bring them forward.
We will. Yeah. We're going to do our due diligence here before we pass this bill out. You can be sure of that.
Okay. Dr. Dave Anderson, could he have his moment?
Yes. Welcome.
He flew a long way.
Yes.
By yourself.
Chairman Morissette,
I bet you're happy to get out of the weather in Chicago, right?
Yeah, it's nice and warm here. For the record, my name is Dr. David Anderson, and I'm a clinical psychologist, director of Lydia Home Association, and founder of Safe Families for Children. I've been working in the field of child welfare for my entire career as a psychologist, and through that process, I've realized that there really is a gap in the system of care in almost every state for families who are going through a hard time but haven't quite met the requirement where state custody is needed. And in some situations, if there is an alternative to support families, then state custody is not needed. And so we developed this, started off as just a handful of people who open up their homes and take in children of a parent who is going through a hard time. None of them are paid. They do so for free. And they come alongside a parent and support them until they're ready to get their children back. Today, as we fast forward, it's we have about 700 families who open up their homes and take in children. We have another 2,000 families that are in the process of being screened. We screen and approve families just like you would foster care. We do fingerprints, we do background checks, we do home studies. When kids go into families, we monitor kids in care just like you would foster care. We help set capacity just like you would foster care. How many kids can one family take? But the relationship is really between the two families. The child welfare system, they do not place kids because this is prior to taking custody of kids. They might facilitate a parent to become aware of Safe Families and provide an opportunity for them to make a private arrangement with another family. That's basically what it is. It's one family asking another family to help them out during a difficult time. We've done this throughout history. Families have been helping neighbors throughout history. I think part of the uniqueness is sometimes we get away from this and we look to state government to help families. And what we found in Chicago is that there's a movement of people who feel like the care and safety of our children is all of our responsibilities, not just state government's responsibilities. So we have people who are stepping up saying, you know, my house is probably a little bit bigger than I need. You know, I have room or I can make room, and I'm willing to come alongside a parent who is going through a hard time. The parent maintains all control of their kids. They could change their mind at any time. They could place one day, ask their child for the next day. They determine how long. Our average stay has been, when we looked at the thousands of kids that we've cared for, our average stay is 44 days. But it can be as short as a day or two. It can be as long as a year or two. It's completely up to the parent and what they determine that they need, and they could change their mind at any time. Child welfare, our state child welfare is our biggest supporter and is our biggest referral source, because we provide a resource to them and really come alongside and partner with them and providing safe places for kids in order to avoid custody if it's not needed. But we also take kids from parents in any situation you could think of. It's driven by this value that children in our society should be valuable for really any reason, and that we should, as a society, as a community, come alongside and provide safe places for kids for whatever reason a parent has. And so we take children, if a parent is in a domestic violence situation, if they're homeless, if they're incarcerated and have no one to take their children, we'll take them for any reason. It's with this, it's more of a movement of compassion where people of goodwill, and many of them from faith community, are saying, I want to come alongside and support someone who is going through a hard time. So as someone said, this is really nothing new. It isn't, you know, because people have been doing this throughout history. I think what we're trying to do is use this to facilitate more people to do it and to give people who want to be helpful, they care for people, they want to help their neighbor, don't really know how to do it. It provides us a vehicle for them to do it. And it really is a neighbor helping neighbor. It's really coming alongside another parent and providing a place for their kids, but also developing a relationship with that parent so that they become almost like an extended family member. I'm a parent. I know periodically I need my daughter, my sister to take care of my kids. It's a normal process of having someone help you out. Many of our families, when we look at all the thousands that we help with, the one common characteristic that they all have is a limited support system. They just don't have the resources, the people resources in their lives to help them out. And that's simply what we're doing, is creating support systems and resources for people who do not have any.
Now, are you outside of Chicago? Is this more than, is this statewide, just Chicago? Are there other branches of?
Yep. We've developed partnerships with other ministries like Catholic Social Services to launch this in, I think, 15 other states currently.
Oh, other states. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Oh. And it's, you know, I think it, what I think the interest that people have is, one, like in Illinois, we save our state significant amounts of money because we're providing safe places where the state doesn't have to step in and take custody at significant cost to them. And so it's significant cost savings. But also what we found is there are a lot of people who really want to be helpful. They like this, they like this grassroots idea of coming along. You know, we talk about it as a movement, not a program, and it's a movement of compassion that is really sweeping communities where people are stepping up and leveraging their resources to help another family.
Now, if I go to www.safefamilies.org, what will I find?
You'll find a brief summary of Safe Families. You'll find all the other states that we're operating in. You'll find stories. We've had a number of national media outlets like CBS, Katie Couric, and ABC, and CNN come out and do stories on Safe Families. All those stories, New York Times did a story on it, and Chicago Tribune, and all those stories will be a part of it that would help inform you more of what it's about.
Good. Senator Mike Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You say that a nonprofit, there's a nonprofit in Oregon, number one. Which is the nonprofit that is considering this in Oregon?
Catholic Community Services. And they're
okay.
Here. They're here. They're going to speak. They're going to come forward
okay.
And tell you where they plan, hopefully.
And so is this like, since it's a nonprofit, there has to be some kind of funding to be able to do all this screening and just maintain the data. Tell me how it's funded then, or is it strictly volunteer? I can't imagine.
The programs who launch it have some expense to it, and the expenses around screening and approving families and monitoring kids in care. Most of our startups are funded through either foundations or local people contributing to raise the seed money to get it off the ground.
Okay.
Senator Winters.
I'm not going to ask a question because I know most of you that are out there that are supporting this, but I do want to kind of answer the question that Senator Montes Anderson posed. I happen to have an incredible community, both Senator Courtney and I, where we have an excellent partnership between the public and the private sector. And when the good senator talked about Dick with Nail and raising money, and when it comes to children and families in this community, we've been tremendously blessed. And so, and I know Seymour and he's and the work that he's doing. So that particular issue I can understand when they talk about volunteers and be able to do this without having to come to us for dollars. And I, to expand on the state side, it is the kind of program that actually has a positive fiscal for the state, because you're keeping kids from going into the foster care system and those other systems. So just to underscore that. But what I would like to know, because I noticed your stats, and you talked about the number, the percentages, the 50, was it 10 to 15% that actually may have ended up into foster care out of your 100%?
Yeah. Senator Winters, 85 to 90% of the kids go back to their folks. 3 to 4% go into the system. And the other percentage go into some other arrangement that the parent has made. And the 3 or 4% who go into the system is usually because the parent might have disappeared, or the state might have said, we've given this child, you know, this parent enough time to get back on her feet, and just things aren't getting better. But with 85% coming from the system as a referral source and only 4% actually going into the system, it becomes a fairly supportive partner with the system and helping to keep kids out of the system.
Thank you. Okay. Senator Bridger.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Anderson. It's very nice to have you here today. You mentioned incarcerated parents. Many times the children of parents who are now incarcerated have been through quite a bit of trauma in their life. And so these children need more than just a safe home and a family that will provide a bed and meals. And so how does that work? Do you have a system for the parent that takes those children?
Yes, Senator Verger, what we found is we kind of ground this in faith communities, and what we find is as faith communities pick this up, they develop this whole support system around the safe families. So, for example, my church has developed a support group for people who open up their homes. They've recruited respite people to take to support safe families who open up their homes. They recruited their doctors and dentists and therapists to provide free services for people who are caring for kids who open up homes. So it becomes this self-contained resource system that comes alongside these parents who are caring for these kids and supports and provide services all for free, because we don't pay anybody for anything, and all for free in order to support the hosts who are caring for these kids.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. That's amazing. However, I just watched the outpouring of compassion for the children in Haiti, and I was amazed at the number of people who were willing to help and wanted to do something. So there's a lot of compassion out there.
There is, yes. Yes, we were notified from our governor, who I guess a number of states were asked to consider absorbing Haitian kids if they were coming. Now that has all changed because everything's shut down. But the but from our child welfare director, his view was, you know, We don't want these kids to become foster kids, and so our option here is for them to go into your Safe Families program. And we had this outpouring of support to the point where when the director said, the governor needs to know what your capacity is, our capacity was 2,000 that we could absorb.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
Because of the outpouring of support and people just really wanting to, you know, to come alongside. And the view is, you know, Haitian kids are no different than Oregon kids, you know, and so there are Oregon kids in our own communities who need the same level of support that you are offering to these Haitian kids. And it's just, it really is a, it's almost a wave of compassion. It's kind of going back to where we were in the 60s and 50s, where people were not looking to the state to be the only one to provide the support for families who are going through a hard time.
That's interesting. This replaces foster care in a sense. And how long would a Haitian child, for instance, stay in a particular family? If it's 2 years old or 5 years old, is that a lifetime commitment that people are making?
Well, that has all changed, because everything has changed from the very beginning, and kids are not leaving Haiti at the moment unless they're adopted. So what was originally the intent was to absorb these kids coming has now changed to where no kids are leaving Haiti, but we're preparing in case something like that ever comes.
But I guess what I'm saying is, would you be opening yourself up to a different kind of a program then, but you're suddenly taking a kid for a period of time from a different country that has nowhere to go once they leave your program? That's a different kind of a program.
It is, Chairman, and I think the intent was that people wanted to respond to a crisis and try and think outside the box. And I think what we let people know, what safe families, you know, parents are placing their kids, is we make it very clear that this is an adoption. We don't adopt kids out of this program. Our intent is not to keep kids, you know, and so all of our kids are going back somewhere. And we feel like that's important in order for parents to feel like they're not threatened, that we're not somehow, by putting your kid with us, that you're not going to lose your kid, or your kid's not, this isn't a backdoor to the state or anything like that. And we make it a very clear decision is we just don't do adoptions, because we don't want to mix that up. Yeah. You know, it's meant to be time limited until a parent is ready.
Okay. Good. Other questions?
I just want to say one thing, Chair Morissette. Dr. Anderson did not say what he said at the press conference. He had but one very compelling statement. He said that most of the young people the children take care of are 5 years of age or younger. And then he said, and most of them haven't been damaged that much yet. Mm. Now, all of you know that once you damage a child to a certain extent, even though we try and try, sometimes we can never repair the damage. They're going to struggle in adolescence and adulthood. That statement really caught me when he said that earlier today at the press conference, that you get there at the earlier, we use the phrase early intervention and everything here. It really helps. Saving money, but it really helps that child really live a stable life. So he didn't say it just now, but he said it earlier, and I was really stung by that statement.
So what happens if you have a young child who is not damaged, but if they go back to their parents, they would be damaged? What do you do then?
Well, we're not in a role to keep kids from parents. It's completely up to, we believe that once a relationship develops between these two parents, that what some states are, you know, organizations might call recidivism, and that's the fact that people come back again, we call it reuse, and we actually see reuse as a positive thing. So if we see a parent who is placing their kids maybe once a couple times a year, or, you know, that we're helping them to avoid getting closer to the line of abuse. They're not going to be super parents, but we know that when you add support systems to people and you provide these supports, that people become better parents. They're not going to be great parents, but they become better parents, and that's really what the intent is.
Okay. Well, I'll be interested to hear from Mickey Cerise to see at what time the state may feel the need to intervene before the child does go back, and that's...
Thank you for allowing us to testify today.
Thank you very much. Jennifer Arias, Jim Sedgman, and Mickey Cerise? Jim Seymour. Jennifer, do you want to start? Who wants to start? Mickey's last.
Always.
Hello, Senator Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer. I am...
Your last name?
Arias Rosales.
Okay.
I am 19 years old. When I was 5 years old, my mother and I got in a car accident on Silverton Road that caused her to get brain damage. I was in the car accident with her as well. We don't know our dad, so we didn't have anywhere to go, so we went to my aunt's house. We were placed in care with her. Living with my aunt was pretty nice for a while, and then my aunt's boyfriend started abusing my brother and I, and then not long after, my cousin started to abuse us. After one point, my cousin had beat me up so bad that nobody knew, and then it was apparent that when they saw me, they knew that it had happened. I went into foster care when I was 9. I currently am in foster care as well. When I was 13, my mom died. She had pneumonia along with her coma, so she couldn't. There was nothing that anybody could do for her. I graduated high school in 2009. I've been to 4 different high schools, 5 different elementary schools, and 3 different middle schools, so I had moved a lot. But I am 19. I drive. I'm going to college. I have made myself successful. I scored a 4.0 in my sophomore year when I failed the year before. And I think some of the things that could have prevented us, my brother and I, to going into foster care, it was hard for my aunt to take care of 4 kids and her boyfriend. She had worked 10 hours, and she traveled a long way from Salem to Wilsonville to get up at 4:30 in the morning to go to work and then come back later. So it was hard for her to try to take care of everyone at once when she came home and feed us and clean, and it was just not enough time for her. So babysitting would have been nice for her. And also if my aunt had some financial support, and if maybe they had like a support group or something to help us, like coming from a Latino family, it's hard because the men play a role like that they're supposed to take care of everything, and the wife is supposed to like clean and feed everybody. And it was hard because my aunt was a single mother and she couldn't do it. And if we had like some sort of training for her to go to, it had a bilingual worker and a bilingual and bicultural worker, that would have been help. That would have helped her a lot, especially if she could have had the papers in English or in Spanish, because as now, she doesn't really speak very much English, so that would have helped her. Maybe like a stipend, if they would have like gone and stuff, would encourage her and going into training and stuff, because it was hard taking care of 4 kids, especially some that were not, a couple that weren't even hers. I mean, she was a great woman, and I forgive everybody in my family for what they did, because I don't hold any grudges against them, because you know what, it's life. Life sucks. I have gone through it, and I'm doing pretty well, and I know my mom would be proud.
Any questions, comments? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Jim Seymour. I'm the Executive Director of Catholic Community Services. Catholic Community Services is a member organization of Catholic Charities USA, and I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 911. I grew up in a home with a father who was abusive. When things got bad, Mom took us kids to live with my grandma and Grandpa Bill. They were our safe family. And this was good for me, but here in Marin County, 17 of every 1,000 children will become the victim of child abuse, and many of these children don't have a safe family that they can turn to. Fostering Hope is a collaboration of public and private organizations. We work in partnership with neighborhood leaders who are determined to improve the conditions in their neighborhood that support families to raise their children well. As a part of the Casey Foundation initiative, our goal is to build a neighborhood-based system of support for families strong enough to reduce the need for foster care 50% by 2020. I believe safe families can become an invaluable asset in helping us to reach that goal, and I therefore urge you to support Senate Bill 911. If I might add, Catholic Community Services is also the, as you've heard, the organization that's agreed to take the lead responsibility for a demonstration project of the Safe Families program as a part of the Fostering Hope Initiative in Marion and Yamhill counties.
I'm from Lane County. I've been involved with Catholic Community Services. You have a network throughout the state, right?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, yes. Catholic Charities is actually the largest nonprofit social service provider in the United States.
Okay.
We served 9 million people last year across the United States. We served 200,000 Oregonians last year.
Yeah.
And in the region that I manage, we served 4,000 families last year.
Okay. So through Catholic Community Services, other parts of the state will hear of this program.
They will definitely hear about this program.
Yeah, okay. Well, I look forward to Lane County considering something like this, and we'll follow up on that. Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Okay. Mickey, you're up.
Thank you, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Mickey Cerise, and I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 991. I won't go over some of the information that you've already heard, and in fact, some of the information, some of the details are still being worked out on how this will look once the operation actually hits the ground. In this particular work group, I think Sasha Pollack, when she was here, mentioned that the department has been involved in the work group from the beginning, and we were. So we had a chance to look at the concept, and just like Senator Courtney mentioned, I was confused until about the second or third meeting what this was all about. I believe a lot of that confusion was the tunnel vision I have as a government employee. Mm-hmm. I've worked in foster care for about 12 years now, and over that time, I've learned the nuances of how those children come into care as a result of abuse and neglect. And as we talked about the Safe Families program, I couldn't distinguish a non-custody situation where a parent would place a child and not have that government oversight. And as we listened to Dr. Anderson, we had a number of conference calls with him. Felt like I knew him when I met him today for the first time face-to-face. But he was passionate about his program, but what I heard that was exceptional was he talked about social work the way social work used to be years ago. These are families wanting to take care of families, that it comes from that genuine spirit. It's voluntary. It has no monetary connections to it at all for the families. They simply want to reach out and take care of neighbors. So when I started looking at it from that perspective, my role in that group became very clear to me. We were to help craft language that would keep government out of this program. And so I think we did that. I think that we did that with the bill that's in front of you and the amendments that Sasha outlined. What we would be doing as a partner in this project is primarily referring families to the Safe Families program. We would, the way I look at it, years ago we had a safety net program in the state of Oregon. That program operated very closely with the Child Protective Services Unit, and as families would come into that unit through a phone call or a walk-in, and that family did not qualify for child welfare services in the public sector, we looked aggressively to try to tie them to resources in the community when they needed those. I see the Safe Families project as filling a gap in that community, that local community safety net that we have. Right now, we don't have a voluntary, free respite service for families. And Dr. Anderson mentioned, if you pull up his website, you can read several stories. And one of them, when he said that, I remembered one that I read recently, related to the recession that we're in. And a middle-class family found themselves homeless, and they had two young children, and they needed to independently go look for work. What they didn't know what to do was how to take care of their children, and it was the Safe Families program who provided that support for them. So that's the profile that I see coming into the use for the Safe Families program. It is a different population than the population that we would see in what we routinely talk about in child welfare, foster care. So I won't go into any more conversations about that other than we do support the program. We had a great collaborative effort. I think Sasha Pollack deserves a tremendous amount of kudos for pulling us together and moving us along. I did notice today she did come here without her whip, so I was pretty comfortable about that. But we managed to do quite a bit of work in a very short period of time, and I think we came out of this as a consensus group, too.
Okay. 15 years ago when I was mayor of Springfield, a 3-year-old Tessa Noel Cull was murdered by her mother's boyfriend. That led partly to the safety net program because she fell under the radar screen of DHS, and they never did go out and investigate like they should have. And we just had a murder in Lane County again of a teenager who was abused by her parents. And I'm very, very concerned that some of these things are below the radar screen. Now, what I mentioned earlier is your role when you're working with these referrals. Now, there's a reason for a referral. There may not be a reason to ever return that child to those parents, even though the parent says, oh, I'm ready for him now, I'll take care of him. But I don't, you have an oversight role that I hope that we're going to deal with this next week on an informational hearing, and you'll be back, and Aaron Kelly Seal will be here to talk about what happened in Lane County. But, you know, we only can go so far in trusting that other people are going to do what they're supposed to do. I think this is a wonderful program, and I hope that it does kind of fill that gap that we are lacking now, but the due diligence of the department is absolutely essential. So I'm excited about the program, and I think it will do well.
Mr. Chair, I just need to weigh in because it's, we have, you know, just piggybacking on to some of your concerns and looking actually at what the populations are out there. You know, we deal with risk families through such programs as relief nurseries and some of those, and Jim has programs. And then we have foster care, and then, you know, they can graduate up to our bigger systems. As I'm listening, there's another group of individuals that aren't provided some of the services that are needed. And I see this one with the volunteers as an earlier intervention before it gets to the others. I see this where, and particularly now, I would think that we'd have tremendous families in crisis. You know, I was sitting here and I was thinking about a lot of years ago when there was a family that happened to be my babysitter, and they experienced some problems, and I just took them all into my home and stayed there until they could do better. And this is what I hear Jim and others saying. It is a community stepping forward, volunteering to help put people and these children in a very positive place. And I hope I'm stating it correctly as I hear the testimony.
Perfect.
Which actually then gets us back to one of the statements that was made about the ability to do it without it costing the state, because you're talking about a community now that has stepped forward to take and to deal with the crises that exist in all of our communities. I just think it's another piece of our continuum, you know, similar to what we did when we start talking about continuum of care in our senior system. This is another one that exists. You know, support Project Independence because it allows that independence. Well, I see this as allowing the family and children, and certainly there's probably wraparound services, and Jim, you haven't talked about it, but I suspect that there's wraparound services that will exist for those parents and others in order to keep this family constellation together. So I just needed to weigh in on it.
Senator Marsalis.
Thank you. Will Catholic Charities include multi-denominational churches, or is it primarily, I see nods, so can you explain a little bit about how inclusive or exclusive you will be?
Senator Morissette and members of the committee, yes, and in fact, while we really do agree with what Dr. Anderson told you, that that the focus will be on faith communities. We see any person of goodwill, any person with compassion in their heart, room in their house, would be welcome as a safe family. And we have very strong relationships. I think it's one of the big strengths, especially here in Marion County. We provide homes for children who need long-term foster care, and we have Protestant churches that are stepping up and donating land for us to build homes for those children on, just to give you an example. So it's really about anybody of goodwill, anybody who wants to be a part of this movement of spreading compassion, coming alongside of parents, and that's already established here, and we would just, this I think will ignite even more. We've had churches that even before this enabling legislation, people have been, this idea has sort of been bubbling, and we haven't quite had the right language for it or the way to move forward from several different churches. I got handed a note today from a member of, I believe it's a Lutheran church, that said, I know 5 people in my church who will do this. Just please contact me. You know, so that's the sort of grassroots thing that this is so exciting.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dick, would you come up, please? We have another 10 minutes, and we're going to lose our committee administrator and your committee chair, so we're going to finish by 3.
Senator Morissette, Chair, fellow members, my name is Dick Withnell. I wasn't going to testify. As a matter of fact, I think Dave Anderson is walking to the airport because I was going to take him to the airport, but... Senate president said I was testifying, so okay. And I also need to be up here just to protect my own interests. So.
Well, were you the fundraiser that's come through with all that money?
You know,
by 5 o'clock, you got 2 hours.
I'm a little bit lighter since Tuesday, so. but anyway, yes. I mean, just say briefly, and I apologize, I don't have anything written for you, but this really is a real win-win. This is changing lives at the intervention at the beginning of any problems at all, but also there's a really honest-to-goodness return on investment. Just as a business person, as a lay person, you know, when you look at the DHS budget and the criminal that you add all those, and also what is it, the youth authority, you're talking about $16-17 billion. So anything that can be done, I think, is to that, that can turn that back, and plus also change lives, is really very, very significant. This is not derogatory, the statement I'm going to make, but government really makes a lousy parent. And this is not against the Department of Human Services at all. Matter of fact, I think, particularly in the state of Oregon, honestly, I think they do a great job. I know there's some shortcomings in areas, but in Marion County, I can speak for that the people here in Marion County are very, very, very capable. And we've done a lot here, increasing foster care homes and all of that. I think one thing for the community is this is a lot easier ask. In our community here, we've asked for reentry, for jobs, for people coming out of prisons and all of that. That's been a real tough ask. We've asked for foster care homes. But this is an ask where you can be neighbor to neighbor. And I think it's time that the citizen, and I'm speaking to myself too, it's bouncing off the wall, but the citizens better get involved. We can't be relying on you as the legislatures. We can't be relying on all of our other social services. We as citizens better get off the rear ends and get in the ball game. And this is really one asset that can be done. My hat's off to Sasha. She did this really on her own accord. And, of course, you got Senator Courtney involved in it. And I think it's going to be a significant help in the state of Oregon. I'm also the chair of the Commission on Families and Children, so I can see this being spread out, information given to the other 36 counties, and it should be significant.
So what kind of startup costs are we talking about?
Startup costs in there will be no startup costs, of course, from the state. But
well,
the,
what's your involvement in
right,
terms of
I've been told it will be, honestly, the startup costs will be about $50,000, but the cost per, you eventually have to play it out for 12, 24, 36 months is about $6 per family. Is about what the overall costs are. Because what you wait for the startup staff, which is 2 or 3 people, you can have that for for the economies of scale work for you. So if initial startup costs will be approximately $50,000 for Catholic Community Services, and Jim's got a commitment from the business people here in Marion County that we'll be able to raise that. Because I think, again, I think an absolute change agent of families to families surrounding these at-risk families outside of the government, not outside of the, you know, not illegal, but outside of the, in a volunteer basis, is going to be very, very significant, very significant.
Okay. Questions? Wonderful.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Very, very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tell them that this will be a work session.
Go ahead. You have something to say to the...
No, were you going to announce that it's going to be up on Tuesday?
Okay, we're going to carry this... Oh, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing. We're going to carry this over until Tuesday. We're going to have a work session on Tuesday. So, thank you very much for being here. We're adjourned.
All right.
Yeah, you would sit here. If I didn't do that and walked out the door, you could...